Welcome to the July 2014 issue of Dialogues in Dermatology. The American Academy of Dermatology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The American Academy of Dermatology designates this enduring material for a maximum of 2 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. This activity is recognized by the American Academy of Dermatology for 2 AAD recognized credits and may be used toward the AAD CME award. Participation in this activity is completed by listening to dialogues on CD or a downloaded MP3 file, achievement of a 70% or higher score on the post-test, and completion of an activity evaluation. The date of original release for this issue is July 2014. The expiration date is June 2017. At the conclusion of this learning activity, participants should be able to delineate the diseases and conditions which are more prevalent among immigrant and refugee populations, such as hepatitis B and C, tuberculosis, human T lymphotropic virus type 1, parasitemia, and schistosomiasis. Identify the role of diet and dietary supplements, such as a reduced gluten diet, increased dairy consumption, omega-3 fatty acids, and probiotics that contribute to the health of a patient's skin. And identify the preferred method of treatment for acne scars, including rolling scars, ice pick scars, and both shallow and deep boxcar scars. Contributors to this issue of Dialogues in Dermatology have disclosed the following financial relationships. Dr. Mary Martini has served on the advisory board for and received honoraria from Dove Unilever and has been a principal investigator for and received grants and research funding from Melasciences. Dr. Murad Alam has served as consultant for and received honoraria from Amway Corporation and has been a principal investigator for and received no compensation from OptMed. All other contributors, including editors, interviewees, reviewers, and staff, reported they have no relevant relationships with commercial interests. A comprehensive list of disclosed financial relationships is available on the syllabus.
Welcome back to Dialogues in Dermatology. This is Terry Cronin, your editor-in-chief. This is Dialogues in Dermatology for July 2014, Volume 70, Issue 7B. I hope you enjoyed our free patient safety-themed edition this month, which is currently available online. In this month's edition, we have three exciting and timely new dialogues for you, highlighting dermatologic care for immigrants and refugees, diet, inflammation in the skin, and acne scarring and its treatment. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, approximately 525,000 legal permanent immigrants and refugees enter the United States annually. Recently, an immigration crisis due to an influx of minors flooding the southern U.S. border has also led to a healthcare crisis that has put the subject of caring for immigrants and refugees in the news. In our first dialogue, we joined Dr. Casey Carlos and Dr. Christine Coe, who discussed the unique considerations for dermatologists caring for immigrants and refugees.
Welcome to Dialogues in Dermatology. My name is Christine Coe, and today I'm interviewing Casey Carlos, who's an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Dermatology at the University of California, San Diego. So welcome to Dr. Carlos.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
So Dr. Carlos is going to talk today about healthcare for immigrant populations and things that we should think about. And so one of the first things that I wanted to ask her is, where are these immigrant populations coming from and where do they mainly end up?
So that's a great question. So there's a couple different groups that we talk about when we talk about immigrant and refugee health. So the vast majority of the people that visit the United States are actually non-immigrants. So those are a lot of the workers that are coming from our neighboring countries, places like Canada and Mexico, and they by far dwarf the other groups. But in terms of immigrants, the immigrants are coming from a lot of the countries we would expect. So places like Mexico, India, China, a lot of places where we have educated workforces that we're tapping into or workforces that we need help with. And then the refugee status is actually quite interesting. So the refugees that come to the United States are actually chosen by the WHO as to who needs it the most. The WHO and the UN try to target people that may not be able to go back to their home country. So as opposed to where you might think like people from the Congo or other war-torn areas right now might be the highest, in fact, what the UN's trying to do is actually get them back to their home country, and that's the priority. So where we get our refugees from are actually people that have been in refugee camps sometimes for 15 to 20 years. So the number one country is actually Bhutan right now for the US, and that's because about 20 years ago, Bhutan kicked out people that were of Nepalese descent because they were not native Bhutanese people. And so these people have actually been living in refugee camps for somewhere like 15 to 20 years.
Wow, that's impressive. So where do those refugees then go from, say, the Bhutan camp to the U.S.?
So it's really interesting, actually. So the U.S. has, what I think is a unique thing the U.S. does, is has a private and government partnership. So once the refugees get here, it actually goes to certain groups that have stood up and said that they will help with refugee resettlement. There is an Office of Refugee Resettlement that coordinates that, but there's actually a lot of private groups. So these people often end up in towns where you'd never expect them. So a lot of small towns in the United States where they might not even have an immigrant population, but then we'll suddenly have this enclave of refugees from a certain country. And so some cities have done a really wonderful job of embracing that, including Lincoln, Nebraska, who has really looked at it as a strength and something that makes their town better. But some towns haven't dealt with that as much. And because of the unique challenges of being kind of the only immigrant or refugee population in a small town, this leads to a secondary migration where a lot of people will move either to an area that has more people of that region or to a state that has better health care support or better social service support, because as we can talk about, the healthcare support is basically based on the state's Medicaid. And since states vary so widely in what they give out for Medicaid support, there's a lot of secondary migration to states that have a more supportive public health network.
So it sounds like the refugee population is at first sort of helped and directed to, say, a certain city or state, but then the refugees are actually free to move to wherever they want to at whatever point in time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think people always want to go back towards their family, so sometimes if they're separated, but that's where you do end up with certain groups. Like in San Diego, we have a large Eritrean population. Actually, here in Denver, where we're at right now, has a large Ethiopian population. A lot of that is because they had a certain group of refugees that kind of set up, were successful, and then as other people came, they had that secondary migration to the area.
I see. Okay. So you brought up a little bit, what are some of the issues unique to immigrant populations, one being the refugee population is sort of dependent on the Medicaid provided by the state, but mm-hmm. what are maybe some of the other issues to be aware of?
So some of the issues are things that we would expect, so things like a language barrier, not being accustomed to Western healthcare and how that works and how to navigate the system. And then some of the things may be things that we don't necessarily expect, which is that they may not be able to actually integrate into the healthcare, they may not have the health insurance, that they may have ideas about our healthcare system that may not jive with the Western thought. Certainly there were a lot of fear about vaccines in a lot of countries. There's some bad information that went out that they were possibly getting bad medications or they were getting bad vaccines or using the vaccines as a secondary effort for political gain. And so I think some of those things we might not always expect or pick up on, especially if we can't read kind of the emotional or social cues because of the language barrier that's in place. I think also that migration ends to a little bit of instability. So sometimes people haven't lived somewhere very long. They may not be educated or they may have their kids in a school where things are not going well. So I think there's a lot of societal pressures that they have, and then medicine just becomes a second. The second is that a lot of times in these refugee camps, when they come to the U.S., they get screened for infectious disease because that's our public health concern, but there's really very little screening for chronic diseases. So a lot of these patients have undiagnosed anemia, undiagnosed diabetes, undiagnosed hepatitis C, or other things that may not be screened for when they come to the U.S.
Okay. So you'd mentioned briefly before that the UN and the World Health Organization kind of choose refugee populations that they eventually think will go back to their country. So how does that play into where they end up settling in the U.S. and ending how they end up getting back maybe to their country?
So I guess I misspoke a little bit. So that what they try to do is only resettle people who were from other countries that could not go back.
Oh, okay.
So basically there was no plan, like say for that Nepalese group, that they would ever be able to go back to Bhutan, which is when they start to resettle them. For groups like right now where there's active wars going on, like say in Syria or in Congo, they are trying their best to get the people back. So they won't necessarily resettle those groups because there's still hope, because this is still short term at this point, that they may be able to go back to their home country. But once it's been a certain length of time, I think they lose that hope or they are not progressing, and then they decide to resettle them into other countries. And they resettle them all over, but the U.S. is by far and away the largest recipient of refugees, mostly from our goodwill of wanting to accept those people into our community.
If they're actually then going to be sort of long-term or permanently in the mm-hmm. U.S., then the language barrier is something that they probably definitely need to try to overcome. Are there things like language classes or things to help them with that?
Sure.
Interpreters?
So that's where the Office of the Refugee Resettlement has some resources. So certainly they try to get people. You get basically about 9 months to 12 months of support when you get here. So they help you with getting a job. They should be helping you with getting a location to live, helping you with English as a second language. And you do get that initial health care. Unfortunately for adults who then become employed, that runs out very quickly. You can imagine 9 months to 12 months is not a very long time to kind of get your feet wet. If you're in a state that has good CHIP programs, often pregnant moms and the kids will be covered for longer, but again, that's not a guarantee.
You've already mentioned that they screen for these infectious diseases, and you talked a little bit about vaccination. So that kind of brought up a question for me. Some of these refugees or immigrant populations, they may not have, for example, the same vaccine schedule in, say, the United States. So do they actually, as part of infection control, sort of go through and give all vaccinations kind of to the U.S. standard, or how does that work?
Yeah, so part of the immigration or the relocation of the refugees is to make sure that they are up to date on their vaccination. So the vaccinations are done. I think the key things that we miss is that a lot of the countries have a much higher burden of hepatitis B than we have. And as we know, hepatitis B, when you acquire it as a child, has a much higher risk of developing into chronic hepatitis B. So that's certainly a bigger problem. TB is actually a huge problem. So basically in 2007, the CDC updated and has done a more intensive TB screening than it has in the past, and they actually just released an update on how that more intensive TB screening has gone, and actually has been very positive. So it's gone from about 21% of people who are coming in as immigrants having active disease when they come in or displaying that after they come into about 7%. So, and that included doing more observed therapy, having more American-trained people that are actually doing the screening. And that's a huge success for them that they've decreased that amount coming in.
Where exactly does the screening take place?
It's a great question as well. So to immigrate, you actually have to see a physician that is authorized by the CDC and the U.S. government to get cleared. For some things, they will allow your local doctor to say that things have been treated. So some of the things that they can exclude you from for coming to the U.S. are things like all the sexually transmitted diseases. So things like syphilis or gonorrhea and certainly tuberculosis. HIV is no longer one of them. So that was actually a big fight. HIV used to be something that you were not allowed to come in if you were positive, but that's no longer the case. So basically what happens is you either have to show proof of being treated or a letter from your doctor. But you can imagine if you're poor and you're trying to get out of your country, some of these records may not be available. You often have to pay for these exams, so it's very difficult for people to do that or travel to see that American doctor or the American authorized doctor to get cleared.
Yeah, that sounds like it would be a difficult issue for them. All right, so I guess then maybe moving on to another question. You already spoke about hepatitis, both B and hepatitis C, and tuberculosis as particular diseases to consider since their exposures are slightly different. Are there any other diseases in particular that need to be thought about?
Yeah, the other ones I like to point out are nutritional deficiencies for sure. So a lot of people have, especially if they're living in a refugee camp, may be anemic. There's actually a really high incidence of high lead levels in people that are coming in from other countries, either from industrial sources or from water supply or where they're living. So the anemia can be quite profound. Vitamin deficiencies as well. And I think the reasons that a dermatologist needs to be aware of that is they certainly affect whether you're going to have side effects from medication. So something such as Dapsone, where we expect to have a certain level of hemolytic anemia. If a patient is already anemic or has a high lead level, this could be devastating. So, you know, these populations are going to be a little bit more at risk to develop some of those side effects.
Okay. So, but in general, if the tuberculosis is caught, it sounds like before they leave their country, they're not admitted until they receive some degree of therapy. It sounds like the therapy, receiving it, is more successful now than it has been based on their recent efforts.
All right. Yeah.
But it sounds like they don't catch hepatitis B, C, or anemia usually, or even...
Yeah, they're not testing for hepatitis B or C. And so hepatitis B is probably the biggest one that we want to be aware of. It's certainly something we're seeing in the U.S. more and more, and mostly due to immigrant and refugee populations. I think where that really comes up for us is when we think about our systemic immunosuppressants. So as compared to hepatitis C, where the patients often do better with the anti anti-TNFs. Patients with chronic hepatitis B actually can develop into devastating hepatitis if they're given the anti-TNFs, and especially using anti-CD20 or rituximab. There's been cases that have come out of the oncology literature where people have actually developed fulminant hepatitis. So luckily, you can abrogate some of those side effects by putting patients on antivirals. So when you're screening for hepatitis B, if you do find a patient that has chronic active hepatitis B with positive hepatitis antigen, I would recommend sending them to hepatology, and they can often start them on an antiretroviral like tenofovir. And then sometimes they can actually go through the immunosuppressants, which is monitoring for that hepatitis antigen and for the liver function. Unfortunately, some of the medications like rituximab, it seems like it's really going to be an absolute contraindication with somebody with active hepatitis B to be on that medication.
Okay. So as our role sort of as dermatologists, what are the diseases that we might be seeing these populations for?
So some of the things that we might see that are dermatology-based are something like HTLV-1. So certainly there's some areas of the U.S. where we see this, but not as commonly. So being aware about HTLV-1, how it can overlap with mycosis fungoides and look just like it. But you have to be alert that you need to check for that, especially in people that are coming from other countries. Parasitemia as well. So most patients are treated before they come into the United States. However, sometimes it's not adequate, especially if you're anemic or you have low nutrition status. The treatment might not be adequate. And so you need to be aware of those things. So things like schistosomiasis or strongyloides may present in a higher population or a higher rate in this population. And like I said, I think the other things that come up are certainly more of affecting your treatment choices, affecting your management choices, maybe affecting your education of your patient, more so than specific dermatologic diseases.
You touched on a little bit sort of some special considerations when you're thinking about treating these patients, like the use of dapsone in someone who might be anemic, or the TNF inhibitors for someone with a sort of an occult chronic hepatitis B. Are there any other things that we need to be aware of?
So certainly the more common thing, so I think most of us are aware that with a patient with latent TB, you need to watch out for your anti-TNFs and some of our immunosuppression. It's similarly true with some of the parasitemia as well. As you increase immunosuppression, sometimes patients may present or have more systemic side effects as well. With hepatitis C, not so much. I think you do want to be aware of it, but since we have such a large population here, there's not a lot of special considerations in that group. I think the main message that I want to get out is the hepatitis B, because I think that's potentially life-threatening if people are not aware of that.
And before, when you mentioned HTLV-1 and being aware of that, are there specific populations in particular as regards to that you think of?
Sure. So a lot of areas in South America, especially coming from the Amazon basin, Japan as well, there's areas in Africa. And it's one of those ones where it's little pockets of area that are going to have a higher incidence. And again, it's similar to hepatitis B, where it tends to be maternal fetal presentation, where people develop more of the chronic illness. And it also, in the pediatric population, it's good to know it can overlap with atopic dermatitis. So there's something called infectious dermatitis, which looks basically like a seborrheic dermatitis, atopic dermatitis overlap. And sometimes the kids will not respond to therapy as well. So again, if you have a patient coming from an area that is HTLV-1 endemic, something else you want to think about.
Okay. And the test to look for that is a blood test.
Yes, it's a blood test. You can test for antibodies. And actually, it's very interesting in some of the areas, because people are exposed and doesn't necessarily mean that they have active disease. They're actually looking for integration of that HTLV-1, because those patients seem to have a higher predilection to developing the adult T-cell leukemia lymphoma.
As regards to infective dermatitis, you already talked a little bit about that. The babies, they look like they have a cross between atopic and subderm, and maybe just don't respond to treatment as well. The HTLV-1, you mentioned adults may resemble mycosis fungoides. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell a little bit more about the presentation in adults?
Yeah, so they will often present with patches or plaques, very similar to mycosis fungoides. Often on histology, it actually looks a little bit even more revved up than mycosis fungoides, so there's more exocytosis, and it looks less subtle than a lot of cases of mycosis fungoides on pathology. And similar to mycosis fungoides, you can present as either a patch or plaque. Patients can present with a leukemic form, which can be devastating, similar to Sézary syndrome, or they can be more of a smoldering, kind of like our patch and plaque stage, or develop into a tumor and then kind of into the more leukemic stage. So I think it would be difficult to differentiate from mycosis fungoides unless you have that alert up that you should be testing for HTLV-1.
And the course might be dissimilar in HTLV-1 associated sort of lymphoma versus mycosis fungoides, or is there some overlap now with more chronic cases when you were mentioning the maternal fetal transmission kind of, or does it not matter?
So I think the key is, for a long time they tested for antibodies to HTLV-1, but that didn't seem to always correlate with people developing disease from it, because what they think is that people probably are fighting it off and they were exposed but don't have active disease because the retrovirus didn't integrate. So in a lot of the ATLLs now, they are looking for that integration, because I think then that gives them a good idea that this is truly HTLV-1 associated disease versus just mycosis fungoides presenting in a patient that's been exposed to HTLV-1 in the past.
Is it a PCR-based test then to look for the integration?
It is, yeah. And right. It's not widely available. Again, I think it's something that when I worked in Peru that they were starting to do. And I think some of the groups that are studying it are looking at this more and more.
One of the last questions I have for you is how the Affordable Care Act affects these populations.
So that's a great question. So it's been very interesting to see this play out. So in general, if you are a legal immigrant or a legal refugee, you are still held to the individual mandate. Unfortunately, for a lot of the refugees and immigrants, there is a 5-year holding for federal support. So if they're in a state that will give them Medicaid support, they may be eligible for the state Medicaid. But from a federal point of view, they are not eligible until they have a 5-year waiting period. Again, this kind of comes back to that state-to-state difference. If you have a supportive CHIP program that covers pregnant women and children, they will often be covered. But if it's not very supportive, they may not be. And then there was what I think is a slightly cruel twist to the Affordable Care Act, which is that they had introduced this bill that basically granted citizenship to kids that had been here that were sons and daughters of immigrants, illegal immigrants, to allow them citizenship and to go to school, which is a wonderful thing, but they are specifically excluded from the Affordable Care Act, and they are not eligible for health care in this. And there's a lot of politics that went into this decision, but I think we're really doing these kids a disservice. We're giving them a gift and yet taking another one away.
Right.
For illegal immigrants, unfortunately, there's no individual mandate because there's really no coverage on a federal level. Some of the states, including California, will offer emergency-only insurance, and they do have the county health networks and the safety net hospitals, but it's really emergent care only. So that's some of the ways that dermatology also can get involved, is if you do have some of these community health centers or a safety net hospital, you can volunteer your services either in person, or the AAD now has the Derm Access Program, which is supported in 8 states right now, and hopefully in some more states going forward. But you can teach your local health provider how to actually send teleconsults if you can't be there, and reach out to those populations if you want to help with taking care of the immigrant and refugee populations in your local area.
Do you have any last thoughts to leave with our listeners?
Well, I would just say it can be so rewarding to take care of patients who really need this help. You don't have to leave home to take part in global health. You can definitely act locally, and I encourage everybody to do that.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thanks.
Dermatologists who care for immigrants and refugees can help diagnose and treat conditions quickly and effectively. Upon arrival in the U.S., the presence of active tuberculosis or sexually transmitted infections will preclude an individual from staying in the U.S. However, in 2010, the U.S. removed human immunodeficiency virus or HIV infection from the list of inadmissible conditions for immigration. Interestingly, schistosomiasis and strongyloidiasis are not included in the routine immigrant screening process, despite the thousands of people that immigrate from the endemic areas of these parasites. It has been reported that foreign-born HIV-infected persons living in the United States have a high prevalence of persistent parasitic infections, particularly strongyloidiasis and schistosomiasis. Strongyloides may present cutaneously with linear wheals or urticaria, known as larval migrans, or as a petechial eruption, seen in disseminated strongyloidiasis. Among the 128 HIV-positive immigrants, 26% were found to have serologic evidence of infection with Strongyloides stercoralis, and 29% had serologic evidence of schistosomiasis. Chronic untreated cases in HIV-infected patients can lead to immune reconstitution syndromes, hepatic fibrosis resulting from schistosomiasis, and Strongyloides hyperinfection. Strongyloides hyperinfection may present with pulmonary edema followed by bacterial and fungal dissemination. This occurrence in HIV-infected patients is usually associated with systemic corticosteroid therapy. Despite treatment, patients have a mortality rate of about 80%. Persons infected with HIV and strongyloidiasis or schistosomiasis may also have higher rates of sexual and vertical transmission of HIV. Classic symptoms of parasite co-infection, including abdominal pain and diarrhea, are not usually present in these individuals, except for weight loss, which is not uncommon in HIV-infected patients. The presence of peripheral eosinophilia or unexplained anemia in foreign-born HIV-infected patients should warrant serum, urine, and stool testing for strongyloidiasis and schistosomiasis. Human T lymphotrophic virus, or HTLV-1, is endemic in parts of South America and Africa, but has been increasing in prevalence in the U.S. Dermatologists may encounter infective dermatitis, or ID, a dermatitis that is associated with HTLV-1, in children presenting with an erythematous and exudative dermatitis affecting the head and neck areas. Since ID is chronic in nature and presents with scaling and crusting in a typical distribution, it is commonly mistaken for seborrheic dermatitis or atopic dermatitis. Seborrheic dermatitis and atopic dermatitis have been diagnosed in 25% and 14% of patients infected with HTLV-1, respectively. The presence of exudative eruptions with secondary bacterial infection and yellow crusting that is responsive to antibacterial therapy distinguishes ID from seborrheic dermatitis and atopic dermatitis. The positive diagnosis of HTLV-1 is based on the presence of four of the following major criteria: dermatitis involving two or more sites, chronic rhinorrhea or crusting of the nares, chronic relapsing dermatitis with prompt response to antibiotics, onset in early childhood, and HTLV-1 seropositivity. Patients with HTLV-1 infection often develop adult T-cell leukemia or lymphoma, or ATL, and should be tested for strongyloidiasis, which predisposes HTLV-1 carriers to ATL. Dermatologists are often the best diagnosticians among their peers because of their ability to recognize the cutaneous clues to the patient's medical condition. When helping people from many different backgrounds and cultural situations, dermatologists remain irreplaceable.